Okay. Hi, everybody. My name is Larry Thomas, and I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank the committee for having me come down here and be with you guys. It's been a pretty good conference up to now. And I asked to share on step 6 and 7, and as luck would have it, I just happen to have all my defects with me now. So it's got to be a God shot. I am living proof that a man can stay sober for close to 28 years and not amount to a damn thing. So I don't know where you think you're going if you're new. Probably Whiskey Pete's after this, but the highest I've ever gotten here is sober, basic human being, active member of my own home group, which is as high as I need to get, really. I've sponsored a couple guys who have gotten higher than that, and they're completely useless to anybody and anything, you know, but I'm glad to be with you. If you're new, I urge you to get to know your defects of character real well, because they're going to be riding shotgun with you for the rest of your life, you know. And your main objective is not to give them the wheel. All right? Just throw them in the back of the car and just let them have at you. And do what you can to not let them run your life. You know? When Polly was talking about her first home group, I remember meeting Polly there. You know? And I think I was a couple years sober, and my sponsor came up to me and said, don't go near that woman. No, he didn't say that at all. Her husband did. I've got my own problems. And you know, when you're new to group and, you know, your defects are what you are. You don't know what they are. It's the way that it is, you know. And I just recently, you know, got the old man for a sponsor, and I'm 2 years sober, and I walk into this big home group, you know, and there's all these guys standing around my sponsor, and, you know, they all got glasses, and they're dressed well, and it's obvious that he likes them better, you know, and he makes that very clear, you know, because he puts his arm around you, and you're in the back, you know what I mean, leaves you out of conversations and stuff, you know, and week after week this would go on, you know. And every week he would leave, I would call up some of these guys. And I would say, hey, Ray, how come Johnny likes you better? And he said, man, he don't like us better. And a week would go on, and he'd go off again, and I'd say, call up Bob. Hey, Bob, how come Johnny likes you better? Larry, God darn it, he doesn't like us better. He's just known us longer. You're the new guy on the block, man. And you know, it just takes time for people to get to know you, you know? And you're so busy seeking approval that you can't see anything else about anything. And that was one of my defects of character that came out. I was always seeking people's approval. And it was taught to me in Alcoholics Anonymous that the last guy's approval you want to seek is your sponsor's. Because he knows you're a jackass, you know what I mean? But what happens to people like me who want to look good and go places is that when you're seeking somebody's approval, you hold back things so that you can look good at the risk of being honest and saving your life, you know? I come to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1982. I'd been in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous from 1975 to 1982. And that was the biggest lie that I told myself, was that I was coming in and out of AA. I hadn't touched Alcoholics Anonymous. I hadn't touched AA. I did what I'd done my entire life. I sat in a room waiting for people to do something for me. I sat in a room waiting for people to do something to me. And it took me years in Alcoholics Anonymous to find out that what I was waiting to be done to me, Alcoholics Anonymous and God, was waiting to do through me. But you see, that was one of my defects of character when I came here, was I've always had the hand up. I've always had people doing something for me. I'm a something for nothing guy. I've got an ego bigger than this room, and I got a 5-inch belt of lazy ass that straps around here where I don't feel like doing things. I don't feel like doing nothing, you know. I wake up thinking about a nap is what I do most of the time, you know. You know, I suffer from postponement, I think, you know. And I'm just a severe case of postponement, I think, is what I have, man, you know. Yeah, we'll do it tomorrow, you know. Drive my wife nuts, you know. And then with an ego that big and a belt of lazy ass that tight, what you do your entire life is you grow up through life doing average things expecting standing ovations. You know what I mean? Yeah. You take out the, you know, you go to work and you think the boss is up in the window going, oh, Jesus Christ, look at that guy. Man, they don't make him like that anymore, you know. And he only took a half-hour lunch. Wow, where can we get that, you know? And that followed me right into my marriage. That, you know, 11 years ago, me and Rosie are busy in AA, and I put this toilet seat on for her. And it was a beautiful maple toilet seat, you know. And every night we would pass each other in the hallway from the meetings, and she'd go to the restroom, and I'd go to the bed. And she'd just sit in there, and I would just rock on that bed night after night going, my God, how selfish can you be, you know? I mean, what are they teaching her at these stag meetings, you know? And I had to tell her. It was just driving me nuts for a month. Finally, she came out of there one night, and I said, do you know who put, I mean, do you know, you got a brand new seat in there, you know? And she says, I know, and it's loose, you know? There's no pleasing these women in AA anymore, you know? And so when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, you see, I'm a loser. I've always been a loser. I've been a loser my entire life. I didn't come here with a bunch of neat stuff following behind me or a normal life to return to. I'd been running the life of me my entire life. I was the sum total of me and my actions my entire life, you know? And I had great folks and a great upbringing. My dad used to tell me, you don't know how good you got it, back when I was your age. I tell you, he nailed my defects of character right then. I've never been strapped with a belt of gratitude. Never. I've got to be beaten half to death today, get 3 guys that drive me nuts and go to Vegas just to get grateful, you know what I mean? I've never been grateful. It's never been a long suit. I've always expected more or different. Never happy with what you got. The grass is always greener. Never content with what's given to you. You know? And my dad caught me at an early age, and I brought that in here with my long suit of defects of character, lack of gratitude, you know? And he did have a tough life, man. The poor guy was a World War II vet. His father choked on his tongue and died in a convulsion. His mother hung herself in a Detroit jail. She was a drunken whore. And he had a dream, and that dream was to marry my mom, my little mom, bring her out of that convent, take her to California, you know, live the good life, you know. And I never want to forget, which came out, and Polly did a magnificent job on 4 and 5. I never want to forget what comes out in an inventory. I think that's one of the most powerful things you can see a man and woman do is when they're riding with you in that car and they start telling you chunks about that stuff and you can see them starting to cry. And when you see a man cry and stuff like that, you know it's hard to do. It was the hardest thing for me, you know. And what came out in that inventory of mine is what I knew at a very young age, and that is I knew my mom loved me. But what's more important is what that pattern would set up for me to do is what I would do with people who love me and show me affection. And you know what I would do? I would play them like a fiddle, that there would never be a time too inconvenient for me not to put the touch on that lady, that there would never be a time for the macho man not to roll up to mom's house and startle her one more time and ask her for a buck or two. And the reason that I tell you that, if I'm new, is because I never want to forget this day when a young man of maybe 20 years old or something like that hadn't seen his mom for a while. I even believe I was younger than that. I think I was a senior in high school. And they put me away for a couple of weeks, and I was supposed to show up that Monday. But I don't. I show up Thursday. And where do I show up? I show up at my mom's place of business, a little dry cleaner's over there in Torrance. She's working a couple jobs. And it's a rainy April morning, 9 o'clock in the morning, and I'm about from here to that exit door. And I'm standing there, and I'm letting that cold April rain hit me. And the only thought that I have is she better have a buck. And I walk through that rain with no other thought or anything in my mind, but she better have a buck. And I walk into that lady's place of business, and one more time I startle her with my presence, which would be an ongoing thing for me and that lady. And I didn't ask her for anything. I just looked around, and I asked her for the money, and she broke out that little Woolworth wallet of hers, and her picture of me falls out when I'm 8 years old on a Little League team. And she gives me that $1 and then $2. And then I take the money, and I run off to Wilmington where I'm going to die. Now, the reason that it brings it home to me right now, tonight, this afternoon, is that you take this same man and you bring him to Alcoholics Anonymous, where his life depends on every action that I take here. And with my so-called desperation and willing to go to any lengthness, you stick me in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you put the secretary of a meeting that same distance. And I need to ask you this if you're new. How come when my life depends on it, I can't walk that same distance and ask a man for a job in a meeting that was going to save my life? But I can walk that distance and use my mom time and time and time again. And I'm here to share with you, if you're new, that it's been my experience that if my alcoholism doesn't kill me, my selfishness and my self-centeredness will, make no mistake about that, which is why it's necessary for a man with close to 28 years to be close to and active in a program called Alcoholics Anonymous, and more important than that, a home group, because I will never get so sober that I can't get drunk again. I'll never get that sober. I need to be close to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous on a regular basis, because that seems to be the only power in my life that can take an ego as big as mine and keep it small enough to be useful. And that's why I need the commitments. Not so that I can build some type of AA resume, is because my Monday night meeting don't give a shit that I'm here. You know what I mean? They want their coffee made, big guy. You know what I mean? They don't care where I'm going. They want their cookies put out on Thursday. They want their coffee poured on Wednesday. You know what I mean? And it keeps my ego small enough to be useful, which is what this step is all about. All over this United States and all the AA little cities that we know, people are busting their brains trying to work on their defects of character. The last time I worked on my defects of character, I had a 5-year obsession with massage parlors. And I wasn't even horny, you know, I'll just go in here. My sponsor's smelling everybody for booze when they come into the door at the meeting. He's sniffing me for baby oil. You all right, you know? I had no idea what was ahead of me, man. You know? Coming into that home group like Polly was talking about, that Bellflower meeting, seeing all those guys around my sponsor was an amazing thing, man. Amazing thing. This thing called unity and stuff. And I got to bring all this back down. And now, taken alone, step 6 and 7, we can ramble around and do all kinds of things. But I got to bring it back to what we're doing here. What are we doing here? What is this whole process about? Where are we in these steps? Polly just got done reading 4 and 5. Where are we in this book? What is our task? The last paragraph of step 1 says, we stood ready to lift that merciless obsession. That's what we're doing here. That's why we're going through this process, is to relieve this merciless obsession. I can't think of a better word for our disease than merciless. It has no mercy. It cares nothing about what you think, whether you're ready to stop or not. It's on you, much like you. You know, it has this, you know what I mean? And I did not know peace. I had no idea what peace was, but I've got to relieve this merciless obsession. I stood ready to do anything because I know perfectly well that I'm in the worst spot that an alcoholic can be, and that is not drinking and not doing AA. There is nothing more lethal than that combination of things. And the longer I don't drink, the worse I feel. And coming to AA and seeing these guys with these ties on coming up from this box going, 30 days ago I was on the streets of Los Angeles. Now I'm the president of the Bank of America. Thank you, you know. And I'm going, my God, I came in with that guy, you know. So where are we in this book? Well, we've just got done taking an inventory and we've seen ourselves for what we really are. We've seen what drives us to drink when we're sober. You see, I'm an alcoholic. Sobriety drives me to drink time and time and time again. I can't stand the way that I feel when I'm sober because I am faced with the very things that we've been talking about up to this point. And I can't get the faces and the memories out of my head. They're with me every waking day. And somewhere in this book it says that it talks about we will know peace. Doesn't say we know it. Doesn't say we have it. I wouldn't know peace if it bit me on the knee. It says we will know truth. It says we will know peace of mind. I don't know peace of mind. The only peace of mind I know is three shots of Kessler's. That's the only peace I've ever known. That's the only peace I've ever known is three shots into that. And if I don't find peace of mind now that I'm not drinking and in AA, my mind's destined to go back to where it once found it. Three shots of bourbon. This time it'll be different, Larry. This time it'll be different, pal. And so I must find that peace of mind. And the only way for me to find that peace of mind is to be close to and active in a program called Alcoholics Anonymous and work in this process of steps. You know? Amazing thing. I had no idea. You guys talk to me about a lifestyle or do you want a brand new way of life? I didn't know how to live. I had no idea how to live. I've been living for me my entire life. I started out this talk saying that I was a loser. You guys know what I am. You guys have watched me come in here. You've watched me for years. A loser is a nice way of saying things. I tell you what I started off doing when I was long before I ever drank. I'm a quitter. I'm a professional quitter. I quit being a son at the age of 11 years old. My dad wanted me to do good. My dad wanted nothing but the best for me and provided everything to make that happen. But you see, I've always had this tug from the middle of me that takes me away from good and decent. I don't know what that is about, but I've always had a pull. And at the age of 11 years old, I gave in to the pull. I was wandering around in a garage with four other guys, and I took a shot of Four Rose whiskey. And I was to find my peace of mind. I was to find something that would make me feel better than any day I'd ever lived sober. It turned Howdy Doody into James Dean in two drinks, you know. But I'll never forget where it took me. And I quit being a son. I quit being somebody you can depend on. And that followed me my entire life. Never been able to follow through anything. Just a natural born quitter. And thank God one of the remedies for being a quitter in Alcoholics Anonymous is one of the most untalked about principle we have. It's called consistency. You can't beat a consistent man in Alcoholics Anonymous. You show me a guy or gal who shows up to their home group on a regular basis, no matter what the weather is in their life, and I'll show you a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the kind of folks that I need to be with, you see. Anybody can come here fat and happy and sassy. But what about when these little storms of life are hitting you? What about when you have these things pulling you off from the inside and these old ideas that you have making you want to do things and stuff? Well, you got people that you know in that group. I tell you, there's nothing more crazy than to be newly sober and wonder where you're going tonight. and you got all your craziness and all your old obsessions kicking in your head, and you don't know what meeting to go to. Where should I go tonight? Should I go to that meeting? Nope. Should I go to that meeting? Nope. Should I go to that? Nope. Maybe I'll just stay home and just work through this shit, you know. 4 days later, you come out, you know. But there's nothing more comforting. There is nothing more secure to the alcoholic of our type. It to be obsessed and sober and know where you're going to be in an hour. Because once I'm with you, once I am with you, the magic happens. Everything's okay. Everything is okay. You know? I had a kid call me up not too long ago, a kid that I've been sponsoring for a while. And he says, I said, how you doing, Billy? He says, you're doing all right. He says, I've been obsessed with some internet porn, but my AA life is good. You know? I said, son, that is your AA life. That's everything to do with your AA life. What you are when you're away from us has everything to do with what kind of AA member you are. You see, but I'm a sneak. My inventory revealed that I'm a sneak. I like to sneak. I'm one of these guys where, you know, well, what you don't know won't hurt you. What I would do behind private doors is my business. And what I do when I'm away from you won't hurt you. I can handle that. I'm willing to pay the price. If you're sober and you're willing to pay the price, go ahead, Larry. That kills more people than what I know. Damn near killed me. And that's the only experience I can share. You see, just the lack of a better word, I can't sin in private. I can't. I can't go off and sin in private. Because everybody's going to pay the price. And you know how they pay the price? In my attitude. It's the first thing that changes. I'm guilty. I'm remorseful. And I'm pretty damn suspicious about you messing around on me now. I'm pretty sure you've been bugging around on me. And I become restless and irritable. And everybody's affected by my sin. Oh, I think because what you don't know won't hurt you. But by golly, you will pay the price of my wrongdoings, believe me. Everybody's affected by your actions, even though they don't see you. I had no idea about that. I come here in 1982, May 2nd, 1982, and I rolled into an Alano club, and like I said, I'd been in and out for years. And I took this inventory, and I looked at these defects of character, and I got the shock of my life that I was a 30-year-old man with a 10-year-old mind, that I had no idea how to be responsible, that I had no idea how to work. I'm a liar, I'm a cheat, and I'm a thief. I've never had an honest day's work in my life. I've never been somebody you can trust. And this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous and a sponsor, first thing he did is he started cleaning me up on the outside. And this is only my story. He says, the first thing we're going to do, kid, is you're going to get out of that mission and you're going to go get your Social Security card. He says, you're going to shave and you're going to shave off that mustache. I had a mustache and a goatee. Now, when you're a guy who's used to hiding around images, which is another defect of character that I have, you never know who I really am. I've always had images to hide behind because I don't know who I am. And it startled me when I was new in Alcoholics Anonymous because I remember being about 90 days sober and I'm sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and I thought, my God, I feel like a phony. And you know what? My sponsor was observant enough to recognize what was going on with me. He says, Larry, that's not what's happening, kid. He says, you're so used to having images that now you've come to Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a whole new vocabulary. It's a whole new group of people. And he says, you think it's another mask. He says, that jacket of Alcoholics Anonymous isn't one to hide behind. This is the jacket of Alcoholics Anonymous that if you stay long enough, you'll be able to fill it with some type of character. I had no idea who I was. All I knew, I wasn't happy being me. And he started teaching me about being responsible and how to start being self-supporting and go to work, earning my keep, little things like that. these things started making a man feel pretty good. I can't tell you how long it's been since when I was new in Alcoholics. It was years. Every time I would stand around guys my old age, I would feel like a kid still. You know, I didn't know that I had a whole list of actions that I had to change about the way I live. I didn't know how to live. I'm a liar. I'm a cheat. I'm a thief. One of the things that, and you know how I got rid of my defects of character? By neglect. I sat in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and I starved them to death. And that's the hardest thing not to do, is to act on a defect of character. You know? I think the biggest thing that I've had to work on in my life, and I thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous and these actions, not work on, is to share with the sponsor and be honest enough so that these defects of character don't become obsessions. That I can keep them small enough, or that they're not becomes obsessions of the mind. See, because for me, behind every obsession is a drink. I don't care what it is. Whether it be gambling or eating burgers, or behind every obsession that I have when I'm sober. You see, when I'm not drinking, I have a relief finder. This baby's going, all right? Sure, I know I'm powerless over alcohol, but my little relief radar comes up, and it's seeking relief. And you know where it finds relief? It finds relief in places that I can have power or control over. It finds little things where I can maybe show my anger or my lust over here. I can control and do that. And that gives me a sense of power. It gives me a sense of power to go to work and quit. Nobody's going to tell me what to do. It gives me a sense of power to steal from my boss. You see, it's never AA approved stuff coming out of here. You know what I mean? You know what I mean? It's seeking relief in the only way that I know how. You know what I mean? And it comes up in defect of character. And to this day, that old relief finder will come out. But because of I know what's at the end of that finding, I don't have to act on it. The worst thing you can do is talk to your obsessions. Drive around. You're not going to get me now. You know what I mean? Is to break the obsession. I remember this one time I was talking with my sponsor, and I was going through this thing with the massage parlors and stuff like that. And he says, you know, it may help if you don't come home on Imperial Boulevard every night, for God's sake. There's other routes home, you know what I mean? And he says, when you would get these urges in your head, he says, why don't you, you know, you got to break that obsession. Get out of the car. Go shopping, you know. Do something to break the obsession. And lo and behold, man, you know, one morning I woke up and Rosie was gone, or maybe even in the next room. I don't know. But, you know, I had this obsession for sex. She had to have been gone. And she was already at work or something, you know. And these ideas are going through my head, you know, and I call my sponsor, and he goes, God, Larry, he says, why don't you go do some chores in the backyard or something, man? Get out of yourself, you know. And he hung up. And that made me mad. So I went to the backyard, and Rosie had some stuff she wanted planted. And I said, oh, man, she's always got work for me. you know what I mean? And so I said, well, you know what? Maybe I'll plant these roses for her. And there was some dirt and a shovel, and I start digging, and, you know, and then I'm cussing, and, oh, man, stupid roses. I'm throwing one of them away and planting the other one and just having a tough time with it. One of my babies calls me up, and he says, hey, Sponce, how you doing? I says, I'm all right. What are you up to? He says, I'm just obsessed with sex today, and I'm driving myself crazy. And I says, Jesus Christ, take up gardening. You know, and I just hung up on him. Get out of yourself, for God's sakes, you know. One of the things that came out on this inventory is how inadequate I always felt, because I really was. And how I've always wanted to be a man, because I wasn't. I I had not the makings of a man till I met you. And one of the things that I used to do, whoever I would be hooked up with romantically, is if I would get upset with them, I would move them around physically. And I'm sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got married for the first time. And I had a little girl, my baby Lauren. And Lauren was about a year old. And me and her mom are fighting in the hallway. And things start getting loud. And the room starts shaking. And I went to raise my hand at this lady. And down there was a little girl staring at me. And I said, no, you don't. No, you don't. You're not going to let her witness what you witnessed your entire life. You can stop that right now. And I chose not to follow through on that action. And I was humbled by my daughter's eyes. And I made a promise to my God and my sponsor that I would never do that again. That I don't want to be the guy that puts that type of action in that little girl's eyes. I don't want to be that man. Now, eventually I had to divorce that lady. But I never stopped being that little girl's father. I never quit being her dad. And I never will. Funny thing in Alcoholics Anonymous. How you take losers and humble them into being men. By their own actions. That little prayer that we have in there, that seven-step prayer. Both steps 6 and 7 talks about cooperation. And that nobody's going to be rendered white as snow. And what they're telling you is to be content with patient improvement, they say. And be prepared to grow up here. By golly, you shouldn't be going anywhere anyway. You may as well just sit in and buckle in and grow up. And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous has done with me. They've taken a nothing, a nobody, a useless piece of man, and made him a productive society of my neighborhood and everything around, and more important than that, a proud member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now I want to talk to you about one of the hurdles of service, because this prayer is all about service. In that prayer, he says, we ask our Creator, I humbly ask you that you now remove from me every defective character that keeps me from being useful. To be in a service and being useful. It doesn't say keeps me from being perfect. There are some perfect peoples around here. They'll show up on birthdays with their cakes and candles. They won't put up the chairs or nothing, you know. And one of the things that can keep me from being useful is my magnanimous ego. That it's too big to do the little things anymore. It's too big to do the little things in AA. I've gotten my 5 years. Let somebody else do that. It's too big of me to leave my guys on the wall on Monday night and maybe shake hands with a stranger. My magnanimous ego will kill me here in Alcoholics Anonymous. You see, one of the things that keeps me from being of service is every now and then I'm a do-gooder, a well-wisher. Where you think that things will be done, you wish the meeting well, but you won't do anything to help it out. I've been caught up in that kind of complacency. I think that's one of the biggest defects of character I had was my complacency. Happy doing nothing and proud of it. You know, the house is burning and you want a vacuum. You know what I mean? And I remember this very well. I remember this very well, being about 10 years sober, and my complacencies hit me. And I had this idea that I want to move in with this girl. And my sponsor says, I don't think that's a good idea, son. And I said, well, I don't think you understand how we feel about one another. He says, I don't think that's a good idea, son. I says, well, we got some pretty good things going here. I said, you know, it's not like your ordinary get-together. You know, we really mean it, you know. And I don't think that's a sound idea at all, son, you know. And I said, well, all right. Well, a couple weeks went by, and I went ahead and moved in. We moved in together, you know. I want to tell you what that kind of action does. That's the old quitter again. I quit listening to my sponsor. I've got it from here. Take it easy. You know what I mean? And I tell you what happens when you quit listening to your sponsor is when this situation starts to choke you out, you can't go to him and be honest because your ego's telling you you got to be right about it. And so you spend the rest of your life trying to be right rather than honest. And you wind up in a situation for a couple years that drives you absolutely out of your mind. But you're right. You're absolutely right about it. And what happens is that this thing starts affecting your personal life. You start being restless and irritable and discontented because you're not getting direction for anything. You're running the whole show now because you can't bring anything to your sponsor because he'll always refer to, well, if you weren't with that little bag, this wouldn't be happening, you know? So you've got to be busy being right. And in the meantime, you've got that bottle of whiskey just floating around you, getting closer. And eventually I couldn't hold a job because I've got this hatred towards my first wife. And I don't want nothing good to happen to her, so I stay poor at her. And the only way for me to stay poor at her is I just quit jobs, you know, because she ain't getting everything, you know what I mean? And what happens one more time is you go to visit that little girl on Daddy-Daughter Day, and this little 3-year-old, 4-year-old Cuban girl comes running up to your arms, and she hops up in your arms on Daddy's visiting day. And she's got holes in her socks. And she's got holes in her underwear. And that's your fault. And she looks at you, and without saying a word, she says, Daddy, if you love me, why are you dressing me this way? Ah, but you're right. There's nothing like being right, is there? Nobody going to tell you what to do, Larry. I'll figure this thing out if it's the last thing I do. And what happened that day is I put that little girl down, and I immediately found out what was going on here. It dawned on me that I hadn't had a ride with a sponsor or a friend for a long time, that I'd been running in and out of my meetings and getting there right when they start and leaving right where they're in, talking at some of the Alano clubs about how well my life is, and going home and dying. And one more time, being a phony is the primary purpose of my life. Don't let anybody in. Don't let anybody know what's going on. And I got a hold of my sponsor, and he said, I tell you what, kid, he says, you move out of that house right now. You move out of that house, and you get to your Monday night meeting. And I moved out of that house, and I moved into a little Busy Bee hotel over there in Long Beach. And I set up shop there. And I'd already lost all my jobs. None of the plumbers would hire me because I'm a thief. The last plumbing job I had, the boss caught me stealing copper. And I told him, well, you know, what was going on and stuff like that. And he says, well, he says, I tell you what, Larry, he says, if you want some scrap copper to go cash in, he says, you can have any piece of copper under 18 inches, kid. I'll give it to you. And I thought, well, that's great. And within a week, I'm taking 20-foot lengths and cutting them off at 15. You know what I mean? Thanks, boss, you know. And he caught me, and I got fired from that job. And I found out that I didn't have the qualities of a man to hold a job. That my defects of character were keeping me from just going and working. That I'm a type of guy that goes to work and I'm wondering why they're working me so hard. And how come I can't, you know, and I always got to ask why. I want you to go put in that water heater. Why? Why now? You know? Always asking why, you know? Why do I got to do this? Trying to get out of it. And I tell you, Johnny says, I'm going to be taking off to Sacramento this weekend. He says, we'll talk about your job situation when I get back. Well, he got sidetracked, and I called up my grand sponsor. I called up Clancy. I said, Clancy, this is Larry. I says, I need to talk to you about something. He says, what's up, kid? And I told him what happened. He says, well, he says, why don't you come down here tomorrow and to my office and we'll talk. And I said, you mean you want me to come to the mission? He goes, no. I want you to find an abandoned warehouse and I'll come find you, you know. So I went down and I sat at my grand sponsor's desk. My God, this was 1992. I sat at my grand sponsor's desk and he gave me a cup of coffee and a carrot. What's up, kid? And I started telling him my little wall, and he says, I don't know what to tell you. I have no idea what to tell you. You know that saved my life? I had been leaning on people for answers my entire life. And to me, that's what a sponsor was. Somebody to lean on again. You see, that's what takers and losers do. They hook up with people to do the work for them. Yeah, I'm a perfectionist. I seek it in you. He says, I don't know what to tell you, kid. He says, you just need to find some type of job that you're qualified for and go apply for it. And you know what? He nailed me. Because I'm a liar. And if I put down jobs that I'm qualified for, well, my God, you know, I'd be raking your lawn probably, you know what I mean? And, you know, and so I'm filling out these job applications and lying on them. I'm applying for being a journeyman plumber, and I'd only have apprentice qualifications. And they find out in a matter of months, and I got to steal and do all this stuff. He says, just find a job that you're qualified to do, son, and go look for it. And then he looked at me, and he gave me a stack of papers. He says, why don't you take these into my secretary? And then he tilted his head like a little terrier. That scared me, you know, so I said, what does that mean, you know? So I took the papers and I gave them to a secretary, and I said, these are from Clancy, and I come back and I sat down. And it dawned on me. If I can do that for the old man, why can't I do that for the guy that's my boss? I didn't ask Clancy why. I wanted to. I wanted to say, why don't you have her come and get him? She ain't busy, you know? You're obviously not that busy. You're dicing carrots, you know. I said, you know. But I kept my mouth shut. I kept my mouth shut. I didn't ask why. I said, okay. And I thought, my God, I'm going to do it. I'm going to go find a job that I'm qualified for. And instead of lying for a position, by golly, I'm going to do like they taught me. I'm going to start at the bottom. That's what the old man did. My dad started off as a janitor maintenance man at a chemical plant, and 35 years later became plant manager head of OSHA. He hung in. That is the faith of Alcoholics Anonymous. You hang in and you work to the other side. And for a slipper, my God, those are magic words. You see, I'm a quitter. I don't hang in for nothing. Don't threaten me with a 401k. I'm out of here. You know what I mean? It's just, I've got to go places, you know. There is nothing about me that say, let's plant and dig in, you know what I mean? I'm on the go, you know what I mean? I mean, I've always felt like I got to go, you know? Like right now, I want to go, you know? You want me to go, I know, you know? I want to go, you want me to go. I want to please you, let's go, you know? And in 1992, I looked at a little three-sentence ad, and it's a big food company that needs somebody to do some minor mechanical plumbing work and know the streets of Los Angeles. And I applied for that job, and a man that worked there at my home group put his name on there. He said, are you sure you can do this job? I says, I am, Chris. I'm positive. And he says, all right. And a guy by the name of Chris W. put his little thing there. I've been there ever since. And that company has been bought and sold and bought and sold, and I've hung in. And Alcoholics Anonymous slowly made me a plumber. Took me out of the gutter, stuck me in the sewers, for God's sakes, you know. More important than that, you taught me how to be a man. You taught me how to be a man. I want to tell you the importance of a home group and your defects of character. I want to tell you how important that is. After I got done talking to Clancy, it was about 4 years ago, me and the old man were in Tennessee, and I'd made a talk on complacency, and we sat down, and he goes, that was a great talk, son. Great talk, kid. I says, thanks, Clance. I says, it's all pretty much true. He says, I know it is. I know it is, but he says, you're wrong. Really? I says, you don't think complacency is our biggest hurdle here in sobriety? Nope, I don't think it is. I says, well, Clance, I said, he says, I know, kid, I know you're big in Long Beach. He says, that ain't the biggest hurdle. That ain't the biggest hurdle in your life here in AA. The biggest hurdle of your sobriety is not complacency. All right, what is it? He says, it's feeling different. Feeling different. Our book talks about that. That feeling of being different and able to prove that you are. And I tell you, if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous or you're struggling with a defect of character, one of the worst things you can do is keep it to yourself. I tell you, there is nothing like letting somebody in on it. Let somebody in on what you're doing. Because what happens if you don't, and this is what happened to me, is I began to feel different. These obsessions had me so out of whack that I began to feel so different that I started doubting AA, and maybe they won't be able to work on me. Maybe I really am some kind of real weirdo, that there's something else going on with me. But I tell you what happened. In 1974, I was in a nut house. And they knew I was different. And they tried to remove every bit of my past. And you know what? They couldn't do it. And you know what? That's my saving grace. My past is my greatest asset. And I can't tell you how relieving it is to come into a home group on a Wednesday night, to saddle up next to my sponsor and my grand sponsor, look for my buddy Frank and John, and know that whatever's going on in this little noodle can be shared. And once it's shared, it's God's business. I don't got to remove nothing. The power of Alcoholics Anonymous in this fellowship takes good care of people. It's designed for guys like me. And I let these guys have me. And what happens is these things that make me so different and unique just become regular old little petty little things. And the most important thing is to move on. Move forward. Make some amends if you got to, but let's keep moving, man. Your problems aren't that special. The highest I've ever gotten here is sober, basic human being. That's it. I'm not going to get any higher than that. But more important is I got to remain useful to you. I can't let these defects ambush me into hiding from you. One of the defects of character that I had, I thought that I was obsessed with being normal. I had to have a normal life. And in this book, Alcoholics Anonymous, or in the 12 and 12, it starts talking about our basic instincts. How everybody has an instinct for making money and having sex and the good life and stuff like that. But you see, I get confused when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I see people coming to Alcoholics Anonymous and they get sober and they get a car and they get a motel and they get a job and they get somebody to dance with And to the untrained eye, it looks like the solution to this disease is normal living. And nothing could be further from the truth. You can get those things with just hard work and good fortune. But the solution to this disease will be, and always will be, me, you, and this book, and the perpetuation of that gift. That is my greatest gift that I'll ever have. I can come and see you every year and tell you about my blessings, how I've been blessed with a car and a job and a degree. And then if you watch me closely, if I'm not careful enough and I don't show up on a regular basis, I'll hang myself with these great blessings. Because I forget to come back to the people that blessed me when no one else would. My primary purpose is not to be blessed. My primary purpose isn't to live in the past. My primary purpose is to carry this message to the alcoholic who still suffers. And by golly, once he's not drinking, you better believe he's got those defects of character in him. Because there's not one goof whose fifth step I've heard who hasn't had these things that they tried to get rid of me. The spirit of identification, that's the thing that binds us. Those things that make us think that we're just too weird to be around the human race are the very things that bind us here. These little goofy traits that we have. I mean, we are nuts here. You know, I was so glad. I mean, we are the type of alcoholic. We are so self-obsessed that we have the ability to look you square dead in the eye and don't hear a damn thing you're saying. You know what I mean? We're at work or something. You know what I mean? And I thank God. I thank God for that, because I've had these things in my head for so long that you begin to think they're really unique things going on in here. They really got something going on here. And thank God for a sponsor who refused to treat me special. My God, that saves a guy's life. When you already think that you're top of the world and you've got an ego bigger than anything and you think you're something special because you've been sober, thank God my sponsor refused to treat me special. He refused to buy into that nonsense. Go get a coffee commitment. Go do this. No special treatment. He wasn't concerned about being a friend. He was concerned about saving my life. And when they're concerned about saving your life, they give you directions that'll make you survive in this life. Common courtesy. Showing respect for people in your home group. And you go into work and you start showing respect for people there. I learned how to respect my friends and my wife and my mother and my father because you guys taught me how to treat you. I didn't used to be happy to see you take a cake. I wasn't happy for anybody. I came here selfish and self-centered, self-seeking, egomaniac. Everything had to be about me. All these defects of character had me, and I didn't know how to operate. But because of a program called Alcoholics Anonymous, you taught me how to neglect these things and take different actions. This is what we're going to do, regardless of what you think. Every time I hear about my sister, I think about this. And to let you know how this defect of character, this deadly sin called envy, I didn't know how envious I was. One of the coolest things that you can become growing up is being an uncle. I think uncle's cool. It's in between dad and connection. You know what I mean? And my uncle was cool. I had a cool uncle. My dad's brother, my uncle Jack, he was a beatnik, and he used to take me to the coffee houses and stuff, the lighthouse in Hermosa Beach, and, you know, and he introduced me to Latin women. No, they were maids. You know, I thought that it would be cool to be an uncle. And my oldest sister had a baby, and she didn't have a father. And she had this son named Ryan. And I thought, how cool, I'm going to be an uncle. But you see, I got to be number one in that family. And that's because I'm a loser. I've got to have all the attention. And the older this guy got, the more attention my dad gave him. And I hated him. Oh, I hated him. I've been seeking my dad's approval ever since I started doing disapproving things. And this kid became everything I wished I was, right before my eyes. Smart, good-looking, gonna go to college, and I hated him. Gave him that tough love stuff. Wouldn't give him the time of day. And I envied him. Him and my dad went places and just, I didn't know I had that kind of envy in him. Well, that kid was going to graduate from Humboldt University about 3 or 4 years ago. He was about 20, 21 years old. And a week before he graduated, he was out playing basketball and he died on the basketball court. I don't have to worry about him no more. I think of all the times that I could have spent with him and been that uncle. Man, would it have been cool. But that sick envy, and I'm not talking about being a newcomer in AA. I'm talking 3 years ago. The immaturity just chokes me out sometimes. This demand to be number one and have the attention, attention seeking. Thank God for a home group. Thank God for a home group that keeps you small. Keeps you small enough to be useful. I didn't like the way I felt about me when I seen that. I was humbled one more time by my own actions. I don't ever want to be that guy. I don't ever want to be that guy. At the end of Clancy's talk sometimes, he talks about being spoiled by our great blessings. Let's not get spoiled by our great blessings. What are our great blessings? We're sitting in it. I sit in it every Monday night. I sit in it every Wednesday. I sit around it every time I'm with my friends. Alcoholics Anonymous is our greatest blessing. And I'm in the process now of the sixth and seventh step where I'm going to get ready to go make some amends. I better well clear up some things and know what I'm going to be making amends for. Because I'm going to go to these people for the first time in my life. And instead of just saying, hey, I'm sorry I got drunk. Now I know what I am. Now I know everything about me. Instead of going to dad and saying, I'm sorry I got drunk at an early age, I get to saddle up next to that guy and say, I was a bad son. You were a great dad. I love being your son. And I'm proud you were my father. And get to be that guy's best friend. You see? Let's not get spoiled by our great blessings. We can work all we want on these defects of character because we ain't going anywhere and they're going to be right here. They'll be right there. And right where you think you got one mustard, another one will pop up, man. You know what? But what are the real defects of character we've got to watch out for here? Are those really the real ones we got to watch out for? I don't think so. I don't think they are at all. I think those traditions are talking about ones we really got to be careful for. How we behave in our groups. Our common welfare. Are you small enough to listen to a group conference or you got to run the show? Is your personal ambitions running the show at your home group or can you sit and just be a quiet member? Are you bringing some type of unity to your home group or are you getting up and leaving and not voting and, you know, it's just something, are you an active member of that home group? Are you putting money in the basket or are you just taking that coffee and donut and running out? See, Wilson was on to something with those things because those were the very defects that he owned. And by golly, if he owns them, I own them. And if I don't have a place to sit and be comfortable and quiet this defective head of mine, I'm a dead man. So my primary purpose has to be to carry this message and to stay useful to you because being with you is the miracle of my life. And the question of humility isn't, do I trust God? Do I trust God with all my defects of character? That isn't the question of humility in our step. when it all boils down to it and you look at these traditions and you've applied the best to your sponsor about your defects of character, and regardless of how you're thinking, you're going out there and trying to be a decent member of AA, the question is this, I need to ask you, is not so much can you trust your God, but can that God trust you? Can he trust you to carry this message of Alcoholics Anonymous? Can he trust you to make sure that the membership is Alcoholics Anonymous only? Can he trust you with this gift of sobriety to perpetuate this gift? I hope he has, because I'm certainly counting on you. Thank you.